Hi everyone, welcome to another Fashion Law Dinner Party. Around the proverbial dinner table in this episode, we're talking about one of my favorite topics, fashion and culture, or more specifically, what makes a great partnership between fashion and cultural institutions. Of course, the law has something important to say about this. After all, what partnership doesn't benefit from a well-written contract? For those of us who are fashion devotees, the links between fashion and culture may not be all that surprising or, frankly, novel. I mean, just imagine being in Paris as a young adult and finding yourself woefully overdressed for a fondue dinner with your fellow classmates whom you've recently met. I mean, who among us wouldn't try to hastily rework their outfit, changing into jeans, a statement belt, ballet flats, and a casual top and blazer to fit in both with this newfound cool community and with the City of Light itself? Not that I'm speaking from personal experience or anything. What we wear reflects our identity, and by extension, the culture in which we have found or now find ourselves. And these intangible messages about identity and culture can attach to fashion even after we've worn it. The celebrated fashion historian Dr. Valerie Steele has called fashion the cultural construction of the embodied identity. One of the main places in which we see this cultural construction on display when fashion isn't on our bodies is in museums. When fashion is on display in these spaces of public trust, we're able to engage with fashion almost at a distance. An observation of a piece of clothing or an accessory's role in our history and in our culture. But fashion displays in museums don't happen overnight. They also don't happen without historical evaluations, ethical considerations, and also professional obligations, which might include contractual obligations. So, what makes a great partnership between a fashion brand and a cultural institution? What exactly are the legal and ethical standards and rules that frame presentations of fashion as part of our wider culture? Is it better to showcase a defunct fashion brand from the past in a museum, or a contemporary fashion brand with a designer who might even show up at the fashion exhibition's opening? How do we evaluate fashion's cultural significance? And to this point, how might legal and ethical standards in the museum world evolve or change to address the myriad of ways in which contemporary fashion seems to push against priorities of preservation and even cultural significance? You might, for example, have seen Kim Kardashian wearing Marilyn Monroe's dress on the Met Gala red carpet a few years ago. Why were so many museum conservators upset about that fashion moment? I'll be talking in depth with Sarah Scuturo, the Eric and Jane Nord Chief Conservator at the Cleveland Museum of Art, about the Kim Kardashian Marilyn Monroe dress incident in this episode. But before we get to that, I thought we might establish a foundation for our conversation about fashion and cultural partnerships over appetizers and prosecco with the aforementioned fashion historian, Dr. Valerie Steele. As the director of the museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology and as a prolific scholar, Dr. Steele has been instrumental in creating the modern field of fashion studies and in raising awareness of the cultural significance of fashion. So, who better to consult about the relationship between fashion and culture in theory and in practice, especially as it exists in a museum?
The museum itself was founded in 1969 as a study collection for members of the public who were fashion designers and for fashion students. And then a few years later, an actual building was built. And so our mission has evolved over the years. Basically, what we're trying to do is to promote original research, creative thinking, and lifelong learning among diverse and inclusive audiences, and to encourage people to understand that fashion is, in fact, an important aspect of culture and society. So to do that, we try and organize innovative exhibitions and public programs and publications and other initiatives that advance knowledge of fashion.
One thing that I imagine you've seen over the course of your time at the museum and of course your work is an increase in the awareness of the cultural significance of fashion. And that goes very much to what you just mentioned about promoting, you know, the knowledge of fashion also among a diverse audience. For example, you just hosted a fashion exhibition on the cultural significance of hip hop fashion, also an exhibit on Latino fashion. So how have you seen the awareness of the cultural significance of fashion shift over perhaps the last few decades especially?
Well, the public is very excited about fashion exhibitions because fashion is something that everybody is involved with. I mean, even from little children, you see an awareness that fashion is part of how they're constructing their identity. And this is very clearly true with young people in their teens and 20s. So I think that museums, in a way, have been pushed to promote more fashion exhibitions and organize more of these. Unfortunately, I think many museum directors see this primarily as a way of, you know, bringing in more people and bringing in more money, but they don't necessarily think of it very seriously, that it's kind of an entertainment. Whereas I think that if you do it right, it's both entertaining and educational, that it inspires creativity and also thoughtful, critical thinking about fashion.
So that's so important because, you know, this episode is really dedicated to what's in a partnership between fashion and a cultural institution. And as you just mentioned, fashion exhibitions are often seen perhaps as a way, you know, to increase the bottom line or just to get visitors into the museum. But there's so much more that can be done. So in your experience, practically, what makes a fashion exhibit in a museum successful in your definition?
Well, success tends to be judged in the museum world by the number of people who come see an exhibition. But I think that that's only the sort of first layer of it, because actually some of the most important exhibitions gain greater importance over time. As people look back at them, look at photographs and now increasingly videos of past exhibitions, they look at the books that were created with the exhibition, and they realize that that has sparked new questions and new research. For example, back in the late 1980s, there was a wonderful exhibition at FIT called Three Women, which looked at the work of Madeleine Vionnet, Claire McArdle, and Rei Kawakubo of Comme des Garçons. And I was so inspired by this show, which had been organized by Richard Martin, Harold Coda, and Laura Cinderbrand, that I went ahead and spent a couple of years researching my book, Women of Fashion, 20th Century Designers, to, you know, answer the question that the exhibition had posed, you know, is there something special about what women designers do? And that this, the fact that this is still something which is of interest to people. Last night I went to the opening at the Costume Institute at the Met, which was Women Designing for Women, which looked back at women designers over time, you know, from the teens and 20s up to the present. It didn't explicitly ask what they did that was special or why they sometimes were very important and other times were minimalized and male designers dominated. But it did give the public a nice overview of the range of different women designers who had had an impact and some of the themes in their work.
Designers who are no longer producing fashion designs or selling products on the market are highlighted in exhibitions as we look at fashion heritage and fashion of the past. And often that can lead to the resurgence of a brand too. But of course, that means, you know, having designs and dresses from Madeleine Vionnet in the exhibition and having other tangible examples of those designs. That of course implies loans and donations and, you know, also fashion brands, if I may, getting into the mix of what might make a successful fashion exhibit. Could you share a little bit about how the museum at FIT partners with fashion brands or even with, you know, other collections of designers or their estates to, you know, as you note, put together an exhibit that isn't just impactful today, but also has really long-term effects?
Well, The museum at FIT is a bit unusual because we seldom do what is the most popular type of exhibition, which is a show about a famous designer. These are overwhelmingly the most popular with the public, but it has to be a famous designer. So they could be dead, like Chanel, or they could be, you know, like Versace. We had a show at FIT years ago when he was still alive. And then after he died, there was another one done at the Met by Richard Martin. Vivienne Westwood had a hugely successful show at the V&A, et cetera. But I think that where some museum directors become confused is they think, well, if I partner with a brand, that's going to be super popular with the public. And the brand knows that it will be somewhat popular and will certainly increase the cultural significance of that brand and possibly its economic bottom line a little bit. But it doesn't necessarily cause a big revival of the brand, particularly if the designer is dead. For example, there was a beautiful V&A show in Paris at the Musée des Arts Décoratifs, but nobody's been able to revive the house of V&A. There have been attempts with some interesting designers brought in, but it was never able to revive. And most attempts to revive brands, like there have been attempts to revive the House of Worth, the House of Poiret, V&A, have been very much an uphill battle. We tend to think back of Karl Lagerfeld waking the Sleeping Beauty at Chanel, or Gucci's revival under Tom Ford, and we think, oh, it's easy. You just bring in a great designer, and then you know that it goes on from there. And then, of course, you can have exhibitions which will further, you know, embellish the brand. But it's really much more complicated.
Are there some important points that you wish, you know, people looking at the museum at FIT and also the presentation of fashion in cultural institutions would appreciate more? So, I mean, you mentioned that, of course, you know, fashion brands usually see it as a way to increase their cultural significance or bottom line. But are there other ways that you see fashion brands interacting in the cultural space that you feel might be more impactful even than in a museum, or that might reinforce the museum at FIT's and by extension, other fashion, public fashion museums' missions?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, I think the more people know about the history of collaborations between museums and brands, the more they're able to analyze what goes on in any given case. I mean, the classic example is back in the 80s when Yves Saint Laurent was still very successful, but already not at his height. Pierre Berger and Diana Vreeland arranged to have a major retrospective of his work at the Costume Institute of the Met. And at that point, I mean, it was organized by Mrs. Vreeland and Saint Laurent himself. So it was hardly an objective view of his role in fashion history. It was kind of hagiographic, but it was a very, very important show. And it was one that caused a lot of controversy. I mean, magazines said, you know, this is like turning over a museum to General Motors for a show of automobiles. You know, it's a form of blatant propaganda for the brand. Almost at the same time, the galleries at FIT put on a show of Givenchy's work. And he was involved, and there was a big fashion, a live fashion show, connections with Bloomingdale's, all kinds of similar commercial things. Nobody complained because it was an exhibition at a school gallery, not at an art museum. So it wasn't sort of a claim that this is art. It seemed more acceptable. Those were similar things, but they were viewed differently. For a long time, brands were not really building archives carefully. And so they tended to give things to museums and on the whole would just lend things if they were asked to. But later they became more strategic about how they wanted to build their brand identity. And they saw that if they were willing to put a lot of money into building and caring for an archive, then they could control much more clearly the messaging about the brand. Building their own archives, and this is very expensive. Only a few big brands were doing that in the beginning, you know, sort of like Chanel, Dior, Yves Saint Laurent, etc. They could then create their own exhibitions. They'd hire professional curators, but of course they were paying the curators. And so the message was very much one of see how great this house, this brand is, which is fine. Art exhibitions also do that. A gallery will show a famous artist and it's not going to be critical, but it will be, look how wonderful this artist is. I think though that it often is more historically valid if you're trying to look at the greatness of a designer in the context of his or her time, to see how that designer related to other designers. So for example, rather than just a show about Chanel, to try and put Chanel in context with other female designers and some male designers of the period in the 20s and 30s and see, oh, what was it like in this era of great female designers? And then how did that change after World War II when suddenly it was an era of male designers like Dior, Balenciaga, Fath? When Fath even said publicly, fashion is an art and men are the artists. The only role for women in fashion is wearing clothes. And when that was written up, some people were going, hello, what about Chanel?
Yes.
What about Madame Gray? But they, you know, Chanel had closed her house. And a few years later, she reopened and launched herself again. But I think those are the kind of questions that come to light more clearly when you contextualize a show.
Given that you have published so widely and have really been, you know, such a pillar of the fashion studies field, do you have any advice for, you know, up and coming fashion historians to try to sift through the, you know, the marketing materials, if you will, and the historical record? I mean, can marketing materials provide at least facts that then we can comment on?
Well, I think that has to do with when you're trained as a historian to learn how to assess the evidence. I mean, when I used to be a professor, I used to, you know, ask the class, you know, do you believe everything that you read? And they're like, no, of course not. And I'm like, then why do you believe everything that you read from a newspaper 100 years ago? You know, it's sort of like, yes, once you realize that, okay, people have a variety of different motives and interpretations of reality, then you can start to see a little bit more clearly what's going on. And it doesn't necessarily have it be clearly propaganda, but it can be part of what people just assume is true at a certain time. You know, I mean, in the 20s and 30s, when there were so many women designers, there was an amazing popular assumption that who better to dress the modern woman than another modern woman? And male designers, you know, we're sometimes forced to say, excuse me, hello, I can design too for women.
Lawyers always weigh the evidence or have to put together the story of the facts. And so your point about really taking, you know, taking out things with a grain of salt, right, is also something that I think applies in a very cross-disciplinary manner. So it's really well taken.
Well, it's also partly just that thing of trying to figure out from what position is someone speaking.
Yes.
So that, because that's going to involve a lot of things. It often involves, for example, the age and background of the person speaking. If somebody is going, Courrèges is fabulous, Chanel is boring, and the year is 1968, then you kind of go, okay, it's probably somebody younger who's really into the fact that Courrèges is violently disrupting the fashion system, whereas an advocate of Chanel might be from an older generation who goes, okay, this is more of what I see as a classic couture thing. These moon girl looks are weird, etc.
I imagine that the point about, you know, Courrèges breaking breaking boundaries and Chanel being, you know, old hat, so to speak. I mean, are there particularly fashion collections or you know, silhouettes or trends today that you see as, you know, the director of the museum at FIT and as a curator that might be particularly of cultural significance or of interest for the future as we think about, you know, the future fashion exhibitions?
Sure. When you collect contemporary fashion by young independent designers, it's a little bit like collecting art by, you know, recent graduates from MFA programs and young artists, because you're making an educated guess on who seems like they might have an impact in the future, even though the vast majority of young artists and young designers will, you know, flare up for a few years and then sink back into sort of oblivion. So it's you're making an educated guess, but it's tricky. And you have to be aware that a lot of the young, I've bought things from young designers who seem really and who are really talented, but their careers never really took off. And others where you think, oh gosh, I picked that one right. Their career really took off in a big way. So I think that like a lot of museum curators who focus on fashion, I look for things that seem to be designers who seem to be of interest to other designers, people who seem to be having an impact, who seem to be sort of ahead of the curve, a bit more avant-garde, a bit more outrageous. A lot of the ones who are big money makers, they're big money makers because they're just serving the kind of mid-range public that doesn't want anything that's particularly new. So sometimes you look at it and you go, well, it might be conceptually interesting, but is it also well made? Is that who's interested in this? I mean, it's a very complicated thing, which in many ways, as you look for like who which designers, which artists are successful, there's a kind of winnowing out process that's occurring almost from the beginning. What school did they go to? Was their graduating show important? What gallery picked them up? What store? I mean, at each point in their career, it can be fairly problematic to be working for a mass market company when you get out of school, because then you're sort of associated with that. It can be a great coup if you went to Central Saint Martins and you had an internship with McQueen, and these things start pushing you in one direction. And people will often even say of famous designers, oh yes, well, before that he worked with this famous designer and that famous designer, and so you're learning certain things along the way, and you're positioning yourself at a certain place within the market or the field of the field itself.
Perhaps the last question, which takes us back to New York and the American fashion ecosystem too, and the role of the museum. I mean, I don't know if you had looked at Tom Brown's, early work, maybe
No,
you would,
I followed it avidly,
yes.
avidly. And I remember going to one of his fashion shows, and a very famous European fashion journalist came up to me and she said, "Isn't this great?" And I said, "Oh, it's fabulous." And she said, "He should be showing in Paris."
And I just read today that he's curating an American Vision auction for Sotheby's, I think, to emphasize American fashion
Yes.
as art, which goes also to this to your great point about well, why not have real heritage brands, like in Europe, in the United States, and in New York, and what does that look like?
That's very, very hard to establish. It's a really a conundrum because there certainly have been amazing creative American designers. But the idea of building a heritage brand so far has not really succeeded in the United States. I remember, I won't say a name, of course, but there was a very successful designer in the US, and their PR called me once and said, "We want to make a donation to your museum." And just to be mean, I said, "Oh, money?" And they said, "No, fashion." And I'm like, "Well, what are you thinking of?" And they're like, "Well, we have 400 pieces." And I'm like, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa. I'll come and look. I might take 10." They were just dumping it on us, sort of like they had it. They decided not to keep an archive. It's expensive to do an archive, but it wasn't the kind of really directional fashion that I was interested in. I mean, if McQueen had gone out of business suddenly and it all became available, then we would have been scrambling desperately trying to buy it because we know that a lot of people would continue to be inspired by that our students would want to see more examples of that.
Valerie, this has been so informative and so interesting, and thank you so much for your thoughts and your perspective. It's been really, really great.
Oh, thank you, Felicia. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
My conversation with Dr. Valerie Steele highlighted how museums and other cultural institutions and fashion brands and members of the fashion industry often have different objectives and purposes. While museums seek to promote the cultural significance of fashion, preserve fashion for the future, and even foster a space of reflection about fashion's past and sometimes its present for the future, fashion brands and other members of the fashion industry might have, shall we say, more timely interests, including creating a viral moment to support brand recognition or sell their products. But at the same time, the interests of fashion brands through their in-house archives and the interests of museums in showing archival fashion that is no longer in a brand's fashion archive but in their own museum collection may not be so different. Some fashion archives in-house, for example, are already following museum-like conservation standards. And sometimes promoting a brand or even a celebrity's cultural significance might meet both interests and objectives without much controversy. We might remember, for example, the example of the Gianni Versace exhibit that Dr. Valerie Steele gave, and think about the ability to reflect on the cultural significance of Gianni Versace as a designer in a way that both preserves the fashion he made in the past during his lifetime, and at the same time, the ability to foster a desire to buy re-editions of his designs that are made in the present. But problems can arise when the fashion made in the past that is preserved for its cultural significance and what we actually want to wear are the same thing. To fully understand the problems, the conflicts that might be at their heart, and the solutions to them, it's helpful to understand what preservation means, what the purpose of a position like a conservator is in a museum, and why, for example, using a historic object might sometimes not be problematic, and at other times might indeed be very problematic. Why, for example, might allowing a member of a religious community to wear a vestment in a museum collection be all right, while Kim Kardashian wearing Marilyn Monroe's dress is not all right? To entangle these complex issues from a heritage professional's perspective, I had a very heartfelt and earnest conversation with someone whose work and scholarship I have long admired, the fashion conservator, Sarah Scaturro. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me. It's such a pleasure to speak with you. I've been a fan of your work for a while now, so really excited to have this conversation.
Thank you so much for inviting me, and ditto, I've been a fan of your work as well.
Thank you. Well, it's a mutual admiration society today. Yes. On this conversation. So you're the Eric and Jane Nord Chief Conservator at the Cleveland Museum of Art. And prior to joining the Cleveland Museum of Art, by the way, I'm so happy you're in the Midwest now as a Midwesterner. I'm very happy about that. You led conservation initiatives at the famed Costume Institute at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So some listeners might be wondering, well, what exactly does a fashion conservator do? And also, what's the difference? We hear, you know, terms like fashion archivist, fashion curator. So what exactly does your role entail?
Sure. Well, a conservator at large is just somebody who is concerned with the preservation of cultural heritage and who will physically intervene in objects to help them along, to help preserve them, either through preservation methods or restoration methods or some sort of treatments. So a fashion conservator is somebody who really just focuses on fashion, garments and fashion accessories. They are different from an archivist or a collections manager because while archivists and collections managers certainly are concerned with the preservation aspects or what we call preventive conservation aspects, collection managers and archivists are really focusing on kind of the organization and the management of the collection at large, you know, pulling and putting back objects, record keeping, things like that. And then, of course, curators, I think the role of the curator has shifted slightly over time, whereas, you know, in the early 20th century, curators were often the same as the collection manager and the conservators. They kind of did everything. Recently, you know, over the past few decades, the role has become a lot more specialized, and they're really in charge of kind of growing the collection, acquiring things or deaccessioning things and interpreting the collection. Although with all that being said, you know, fashion conservators are also interpreting the collection, as are collections managers. And when I was at the Costume Institute, you know, everyone there was actually an expert on fashion in some way. They all knew fashion history and they all could tell you what something meant.
That's very helpful. And it also points to, I think, this understanding of what we get from an object of fashion in terms of knowledge, in terms of information. So would you say perhaps that
a fashion conservator is more interested in keeping a fashion garment in its status quo state from a preservationist standpoint as compared to an archivist or a curator?
No, not necessarily. I think the goals of the curators, conservators, and archivists are often very much aligned. It is to ensure that the garment, yes, is preserved, but that it can best represent what it is. And so sometimes that does mean we have to treat it in order to get it to a state where it can reveal the meanings it's supposed to have. You know, it can be put onto a mannequin or something.
A lot of brands just see fashion as communicating the meaning that it is what it is, meaning it represents the brand. And
yeah.
And so I think that that's where I'm seeing a lot of dissonance between brands and cultural institutions, because sometimes, especially as we go on, sometimes fashion is what it is. It represents the brand. And at other times it represents something else. And I think the Kim Kardashian dress is also a great example of this, because even though it's not a brand, it represented her through Marilyn, and it was all about her. It wasn't about the dress as it is what it is.
Definitely. I look forward to talking a little bit more about the Kardashian Monroe thing. But to go back to a possible dissonance between what fashion archives are trying to achieve with what fashion conservators are trying to achieve, I actually think there are a lot of similarities. And, you know, fashion conservators sometimes get this bad rap that we are trying to prohibit access, or we are trying to block access. And actually, as a field, all we are about is providing access. We want to provide the access to the garments in a safe and responsible way that is sustaining, you know, can be sustained for the future. I think fashion archives, I've been very interested in seeing that, you know, the fashion archives are housed in this brand or PR or marketing departments. And it makes a lot of sense, because of course these objects can be used for both inspiration purposes, but also messaging purposes and, you know, consolidating the brand identity. And, you know, so fashion archives are going to want to be using these garments for these purposes, which might mean, you know, putting them on the red carpet or using them in ads or things like that. But at the same time, they still also want to make sure their assets, you know, stay and that their assets aren't damaged. And so they too are invested in conservation, but perhaps not such a high level of conservation, a conservation that enables some sort of play, you might say, but we'll also still be able to kind of fix maybe damage that was done. One point I really wanted to bring up is that I find it very interesting that a lot of in-house archives will not actually hire conservators. Almost none of them have in-house conservators. Instead, if they do, they will hire, you know, contract conservators. But a lot of them will actually just send the garments to the ateliers to be repaired. And that in-house repair is really, really interesting, because from a conservation perspective, we are really focused on the who the stakeholders are and, you know, the designer or the artist's intent. And what I find is that if a garment is going to the in-house archive to be repaired, there actually is a genealogical trail of how these techniques were originally done or, you know, taught. And so in some way, an in-house repair can even be more authentic and more important than an actual scientific conservation repair.
So that's fascinating to hear from your conservator point, especially, you know, from my perspective. I've tried to think about in my own work how fashion objects that are outside of a cultural institution, so in a brand, for example, as you're mentioning, that are close to an atelier that are in an in-house archive, can be preserved and, you know, protected, for lack of a better word, without being in a cultural institution. And I've theorized that just from the idea of, well, like we, you know, extend cultural property protection to Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa. So we should extend, you know, cultural heritage protection to, you know, let's say I've talked about mainly with Italian fashion, a Ferragamo shoe that's in the Ferragamo Museum, or a Gucci bag that happens to be in, you know, the privately owned Gucci archive. And, you know, one of the things, however, that's really problematic or scary for many brands about cultural property protection is this idea that the object is frozen. You can't touch it. You can't do anything with it. And of course, there are some limits to that. So for example, you know, under Italian law, you can't notify an object as cultural property individually if the author's still living, or depending on the cultural interest, if 70 years hasn't passed from the date of the object's creation, or 50 years, again, depending on whether it's artistic interest or more of a national cultural interest. So there's this fear on the part of brands, well, the state's going to come and declare my archive or individual objects to be cultural property. And then, you know, I'll be like everyone else in Italy who's hiding their artistic objects in house because they don't want the state to know, you know, that I have this thing from the Renaissance, because, you know, I have to preserve it and do all these things. But So I mentioned that because what you just said shows that actually in-house, when you keep things outside the law, or even if you keep them outside of a cultural institution like a museum, there are still opportunities following, you know, some standards, some guidelines, even from an external conservator standpoint, to have a provenance trail, if you will, or to have something that still really tells you about the object, what it is and what it means in that brand universe. And that can be culturally valuable.
You know, I think there are a lot of conservation procedures that are really helpful for archives to start doing if they are not already, which one of the main ones is the condition report, you know, taking that baseline health check of an object and seeing how it might be changing over time, because that can alert you to perhaps some issues that you might have. And so then you can seek attention when you need to. Another would be doing treatment reports, so that everything that you've ever done to this is somehow documented, both in photographic and video and written documentation. And so again, the story of the object kind of moves along with it, along its life, you know, span. One thing that conservators do that I don't think is so well known is that there's this misconception that we are trying to freeze things in time, and that's not what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is instead ethically and responsibly manage change. We are all about change management. And I think if there's a recognition from archives and museums that your objects will change, and especially if they're fashion objects that are made from all these wonderful synthetics, they're going to change pretty rapidly in a foreseeable, you know, lifetime. And so a conservator can help forecast what that change might be and can help archives deal with that change.
So those are all, I think, really important takeaways, especially for the in-house fashion lawyers that might be listening in, or other lawyers who are counseling clients. I mean, thinking about how you can incorporate that type of change management into donation agreements, for example, or loan agreements, or even just contractual loaning of a garment to a celebrity, for example, right? I mean, thinking, just changing the way you think about the dress as a piece of property, as something that will change.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think also what conservators are becoming more familiar with is that their condition reports are actually often used as legal documents to document that kind of change. And so assessing risk tolerance is really important, obviously, when you create one of these documents, and acknowledging, especially if it is historic dress, that it will get damaged in the wearing process. It's just how much damage are you willing to accept?
Yes.
And also, what is the plan to deal with that damage after it happens?
Yes, which I would say too, to emphasize, can be as much a business decision as a cultural heritage decision, especially for a fashion brand. So sometimes, you know, as you say, people have divergent ideas about what conservatives or cultural heritage specialists do, but in reality, they can be good for the bottom line too of your brand.
Right, exactly. And I think this also gets to a really important point that I want to bring up is that there are actually kind of two kinds of damage that can happen to a garment. One is the material damage, the physical damage, and then the other is the kind of conceptual or the intangible damage to the meaning. And what we might find is that by the wearing of something, maybe the material aspects of it were damaged. However, conceptually, it's grown in importance. Its aura has been increased. You know, it's somehow that much more valuable. And we see this, you know, when Ripley's re-evaluated the Monroe dress after Kardashian wore it, it actually increased in value, even though it was materially damaged. And I might add, I do think it was in part conceptually damaged, because what was most problematic with her wearing that dress, besides the material damage aspects, was that, you know, the dress itself was specifically meant for a specific body type and a specific skin tone, and was intended to make the wearer seem naked. And we did not see that conceptual alignment at all with how it was worn. You know, it didn't even fit. And it definitely didn't make Kardashian look naked. It didn't even match her skin tone. And so conceptually, there was a misalignment with what that dress was meant to mean, in my opinion.
Yeah, so that brings up a really good practical case study to apply these, you know, notions of fashion conservation and preservation, you know, too. So let's talk a little bit more about the Kim mm-hmm. Kardashian example. So basically what happened was Kim Kardashian wore Marilyn Monroe's dress, which is preserved in Ripley's, believe it or not, a for-profit, you know, if we want to call it a cultural institution liberally, I guess we could call it that. But let's just call it what it is, a for-profit corporation that has this as part of its collection and wore it on the red carpet. Of course, you know, being outside of a cultural institution like the Met, now, granted, I don't know if Ripley subscribes to any, you know, professional ethical guidelines. So disclaimer, but that having been said, you know, not being in the Costume Institute or even in a museum like the Cleveland Museum of Art, which would follow specific professional guidelines to preserve the dress and in its handling, let's just say that a more liberal treatment of the dress could be made, including wearing it. So there weren't any, legal stops to Kim Kardashian wearing the dress, of which I'm aware. So this case really, I would say, spotlighted the importance of conservation, because you and other colleagues came out and said, wow, I saw that on the red carpet. And I thought, that's terrible. I'm not going to say how you thought. I mean, I hope you'll tell me how you thought. But that's certainly one of the reactions. On the other hand, of course, you had people saying, well, wait a minute, I go vintage shopping and I buy, you know, all these great dresses from the 60s too. And maybe I wear them. I'm reading Jenny Walton's newsletters now. And so I see a lot of this, you know, thinking about vintage and obviously archival fashion is huge. But, you know, what's the difference between Kim Kardashian wearing Marilyn Monroe's gown and me wearing vintage, for example? I mean, some people might have thought that too. So could you maybe tell us a little bit more about how you felt when you first saw it, and then maybe some of your thoughts on why that was such a unique case too? I mean, why that was so, I know you've said a little bit about why it was problematic, but compared to someone who wears vintage to a party, for example, you know, I mean, how do we think about fashion? And this sure. fashion is different.
Yeah, that's a really great question. It's got a lot of different pieces to it. So if I can just kind of work through my thought process. When I first saw this, I was, you know, shocked, obviously. I think a lot of us were. and annoyed. And I was more concerned about the impacts that it would have in terms of setting precedent, so that other conservators would then have to, and archivists would then have to start facing more and more requests to use garments held in collections. That was my first kind of feeling. And then, you know, as I started thinking more and more about it, and, you know, I'm actually writing my dissertation on the history of fashion conservation, and I've been looking really deeply into how our ethics have evolved and how they've, you know, where they are now and how they're changing. Another area that really kind of frustrated me was that there was a really overly simplistic discourse in the media where it positioned conservators and curators as against the wearing of historic clothing in all circumstances, which is not the case at all. And in fact, ICOM Costume, so it's the International Council of Museums, the Committee for Costume, reissued a prohibition that they have created, or they had created in 1980, the late 1980s, about, you know, not wearing historic costume held in collections. And they were immediately called out by a curator at Te Papa Museum because, again, we want to position conservation as being a way that people can access cultural heritage. And so there are actually instances where people or communities being able to access cultural heritage that is held in collections is one of the most ethical things we could be doing. That if these communities want to wear clothes from their culture that are held in collections, then oftentimes it is the conservator's job to figure out how to do that as safely as possible. And I mean, this is most clear-cut, obviously, with Indigenous communities whose artifacts are held in collections, but we can also think of it, you know, say perhaps for religious reasons, that might also want to be the case. So I found the dialogue to be really overly simplistic and problematic. And there's another aspect where Ripley's is kind of this gray ground, but if we were to think theoretically about how an object in a collection is different than a piece of vintage, I've found Igor Kopytov's work. He's an anthropologist who wrote in the 1980s about the biography of objects. I've found his work to be really helpful in grounding how a collection object is different than vintage. You know, essentially, he talks about the circulation of objects, and he comes up with this term called singularization, which is when an object is removed from circulation and kind of held in a different way, or held in a collection. And we can think about that when an object becomes musealized, right? It's pulled from circulation and all of a sudden it develops its own unique ontological status and it just is a completely different thing. It's not quite fashion. So once that happens to an object, then that is when all of a sudden these conservation protocols are, you know, applied over it, where we start doing the condition reports and we limit handling and we limit wearing and things like that. And so I firmly believe that vintage that is just out there circulating on the market should be worn and should be bought. Yet I know it's difficult to understand that an object can kind of undergo this transformation once it's kind of plucked from the world of retail and brought into these cultural institutions.
So in many ways, what you're talking about too might be that a fashion object becomes musealized or taken out or singled out, also when it's no longer put to its original function. Yes. And I think that might be something that, you know, people understand much more easily. This again, exactly, you know, matching what you're saying, this idea that vintage is still in circulation and meant to be worn. We might even think of objects that are in fashion archives in-house as still serving business purposes and ends. But fashion objects that are in a collection, because they've been taken out from their original function for another purpose, should be treated according to that purpose. and mm-hmm. not according to other purposes. So is that, do you think that's a fair?
Yeah, that's a great assessment. Thank you.
Lawyers listening in, think about that the next time you're drafting a contract. So that's very, I mean, that's very helpful. And I think then we might perhaps be able to articulate our outrage too at why, you know, when we saw Kim Kardashian on the Met Gala red carpet, we were so disturbed. But certainly there, have you seen any other examples that you feel like would also approximate that, or other examples of fashion conservation that showcase how fashion objects really straddle these two spaces between being presented in a museum and still put to business purposes? I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of so many fashion exhibits I see, you know, whether it's at the Met or quite frankly, so many other places. I'm a huge label reader. So I'm the museum visitor nerd that kind of like goes up to the, you know, museum label and reads, oh, who is it from? And I'm always so excited when I see like Chanel Patrimoine or something on it, because I think, oh, great, that came right from the house. But I mean, I was really struck and moved by the Heavenly Bodies Fashion and the Catholic Imagination exhibit. And I know that you were at the Costume Institute when they put that exhibit on, mainly because the vestments from the Catholic Church were so separate. Talk about taking things out and putting them in a different space. So could you talk a little bit about your experience with that exhibition? Because I mean, I think there's just so much there to learn from.
Yeah, that was a really challenging and wonderful show to work on. I was really fortunate that I got to go to the sacristy of the Sistine Chapel where those vestments were borrowed from, and to, you know, see them in situ and to assess them and measure them and, you know, make sure that we could prepare for their display as best as possible. They were obviously displayed discreet from the fashion artifacts. And of course, that is all comes as part of the negotiation with whatever the lenders are. You want to always, you know, make sure you are understanding how they should be displayed and alongside what other objects should they be displayed. And your listeners may or may not know, but that, you know, if you're trying to borrow something from a house, they will often ask you like, well, who are the other designers? Because maybe they want to be part of that. And maybe they don't want to be part of that. So that also comes into the discussion. But that exhibition itself had some challenges in that a big portion of it was held in the cloisters. And the cloisters has some spaces that are kind of considered inside-outside spaces or cannot, you know, hold standard museum levels constantly or all the time. And so again, that was me working alongside my colleagues trying to figure out how to best withhold or uphold museum standards and best preserve the artifacts. And in cases where we couldn't, negotiating with the lenders, letting them know these are the display kind of parameters that we're able to sustain. And is that something that is acceptable to you? And more often than not, the, you know, fashion houses would of course say yes. And I don't even think we would offer that to museums because museums would just be like, no, you know, fashion houses are becoming a little more, fashion houses can be a bit more flexible, I think, in what they can allow because they are for profit. But that being said, and to speak about the generation of a lot of fashion exhibitions that we're seeing that are kind of being generated from the fashion houses themselves, a lot of fashion houses are developing archives that are more and more aligned with museum protocols and museum practices, which ironically, it's actually making it more expensive for now museums to borrow pieces from these houses because they're shipped with art shipment. They're often shipped with couriers. They're shipped or treated in, you know, exactly how other museums would treat their artwork. And so it's becoming more and more costly. At the same time, these houses are touring their collection of or their archive pieces a lot. And I think most conservators would tell you this, and I think curators would also tell you this, that the more you display artifacts, the worse they look. I mean, the more damage they have because of all the handling to, you know, dressing and undressing mannequins and packing and unpacking and all the light display and dust, you know, exposure. As these fashion houses are generating and creating their own exhibitions, they're both competing with other museums who are trying to borrow these pieces, but they're also destroying, in a material sense, their own assets.
So I think that's a really important takeaway for, you know, fashion lawyers, just because obviously when you represent a fashion brand, you're also, you're thinking about tangible products, but also intangible, of course. You know, in the heritage space, we think about intangible as the values or as the interests that are assigned to an object. But of course, we also have intangible property like a trademark that is, you know, a symbol that then is attached to a material good, but then in and of itself has all this goodwill caught up in it. So, you know, when we see, I think of, you know, the Dolce & Gabbana dresses I saw in, you know, the Met in the Byzantine area, for example, you know, then you suddenly the notion of, you know, the Dolce & Gabbana Alta Moda shows in the middle of Naples or elsewhere that are communicating this, you know, over the top gold aesthetic makes sense, you know, historically. And so that also can be part of the goodwill. But as you say, it's a fine line to walk in terms of presenting your fashion as culturally significant like works of art, because you might in fact be following guidelines where you lose some of that intangibleness. And also, depending on how you go about it, you know, you might also, just as preserving can be good for your brand, at other times it might also compromise or make more complex that intangible value and goodwill that we assign to fashion brands. So that's a thank you for that, because I think that's a very important takeaway. I do want to be sure to give some attention to the Cleveland Museum of Art, because I think that we give a lot of attention to New York and to, you know, other fashion capitals, but the Midwest certainly has its fair share of fashion exhibits and also really great collections. So would you like to tell us a little bit, Sarah, about what's going on now at the Cleveland Museum of Art and what you're preserving in your role there, and maybe what's coming up too there, in case we have anyone in the area who might want to go see an upcoming exhibition.
Sure. Yeah. So whereas at the Costume Institute, I was, you know, in charge of just one collection, at the Cleveland Museum of Art, I'm in charge of the preservation of our encyclopedic collection. And it really is an incredible, stellar collection to be working with. And, yet at the same time, I think Cleveland is taking advantage of my expertise in that we are starting to generate some fashion exhibitions. We currently have an exhibition up right now called Egyptomania, Fashion's Conflicted Obsession, and it does deal with the sticky topic of appropriation in fashion and when it might be a good thing and when it might not be. We also have an upcoming exhibition that's opening in April on Korean couture. And that's really wonderful because it kind of presents a genealogy of Korean fashion. And it has some amazing archaeological pieces that, you know, have never really left Korea. They've actually been recently excavated that we'll be able to show. And so I'm really thrilled to be working with those exhibitions. And I'm working alongside a colleague. His name is Darnell Lisby. He's our assistant fashion curator, who I also had the joy of working with at the Costume Institute for a short amount of time. So yeah, there's some really great fashion happening in Cleveland. There's also, of course, the Kent State University Museum, for somebody who's never been there, which also has a lineage of Costume Institute curators that have worked there. Stella Blum and Jean Druzidow have worked there. And then there's the Western Reserve Historical Society, which has one of the best fashion collections in the U.S. as well. So Northeast Ohio might not seem like a fashion powerhouse, but I think we're slowly making our way there. The one thing I really would like your listeners to know is that conservators follow a code of ethics. And we first had this code established in 1968. And over time, of course, it's grown and changed a little bit. And it's actually undergoing revision right now to more explicitly focus on people, or to center people at the core of what it is that we do. But this code of ethics really prioritizes certain things such as minimal intervention, reversibility of our actions. In some ways, it follows the Hippocratic Oath, such as do no harm. So we're trying to, again, not do material harm, but also not do conceptual harm to artifacts. We try to honor the artist's intent or the community's intent who's created that. And so the conservator's decision-making process and our complete, you know, philosophical framework in which we work is really predicated on this code of ethics. And so to not understand that that is why we do what we do is a real loss.
I would also say, just for fashion lawyers that are listening in, that's a real opportunity to, I mean, following the ethical code that you mentioned, the ICOM code, and even the even more specific codes present real opportunities to incorporate them into contracts and other agreements. So whether you're hiring a conservator in-house for a fashion archive, or whether, you know, you're donating an object or thinking about loaning an object, I mean, to know that there are these professional standards and ethical codes out there that can easily be incorporated and made legally binding in an agreement is really important.
Yeah, definitely. So each code, you know, each country has their own code, but it's they're very, very similar. And so it would definitely, when even with our own legal paperwork with, you know, museums, we always say that we follow the AIC or the American Institute for Conservation Code of Ethics in all that we do.
So many fashion lawyers, at least in my experience, when, especially in a place like the United States, where we certainly think about conservation and preservation through a museum box, but we don't necessarily think about it outside the museum box. So when you encounter objects like fashion that live outside of a museum, and I think I was so thankful for what you said about thinking about how the fashion object is taken out of its, you know, its usual context, to think about why it needs to be preserved and the difference between that and vintage. And, you know, some individuals might feel like they themselves want to do that process, want to take it out. If you buy something, for example, that's vintage and you want to donate it, or if, you know, you're a fashion archive and you want to found your own museum, for example. So sometimes when I talk to a fellow lawyers, especially those that interact with the fashion industry, they say, well, no, you know, we do IP and we do mergers and acquisitions, and, you know, okay, the archive might be of interest if we're selling the company, but, you know, why else do I need to think about heritage? So, you know, I always think it would be useful to have like a mini checklist to think about, okay, you know, if I'm interacting with a museum for my fashion brand, what do I want to know? I mean, from our conversation, I've taken away, you want to know that conservators, you know, support change in the object. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not as though the museum or the conservator is your enemy. I think that's takeaway number one from my conversation.
Yeah. And rather than support change, I think I would say we manage change.
Thank you. Thank you. See, this is why it's a jointly authored checklist. So conservators manage change. And so, you know, if you have an object that is made of a specific type of unique material or something, and that you just know that conservators are your friends, if you're loaning to a museum, consider, you know, incorporating ethical guidelines and looking to ethical guidelines to also shape how your archivists interact with fashion objects that you, from past collections that you might have preserved. So those are two takeaways right off the bat that I've thought of from our conversation.
Yeah. And I would also go further to position, you know, conservators as really being kind of value added for fashion archives, because not only can we, yes, identify materials and techniques, sometimes we're able to actually tell you how something was done if that technique has been, say, lost to that house. We might be able, through our research, to help you recreate it. That's one aspect. And another really interesting example that is relatively recent is the Balenciaga Archive, or the Balenciaga Company, actually sponsored the PhD research of a fashion conservator. Her name's Stephanie Ovid. To focus on the preservation challenges of specific Balenciaga garments, particularly those by Nicola Ghesquier. And so that in itself is, I think, a wonderful example of how fashion archives are really looking towards the future and wanting to preserve their assets and wanting to grow knowledge around their assets and also the challenges that those assets might have.
So that's fantastic. And I did not know that Balenciaga did that. And that, you know, from my perspective, is just another way that fashion brands can really be impactful in the cultural heritage space beyond fashion exhibits. I think of Fendi, who is participating in the Adopt a School initiative, mm-hmm. for example, in Italy, because they're very concerned about losing the knowledge of artisans and not having enough artisans to make their products in the future. Well, you know, right, just as you invest or support schools, why not support doctoral research that might, you know, allow you to reconstruct, as you just said, you know, the way that something was made. So thank you, Sarah, because I did not know that. And I think that's another huge takeaway, is think broadly about, you know, what it means to support heritage as a fashion brand, and look beyond your own fashion archive, if I may.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, conservation, we like to think of it as a three-legged stool, although I think it actually by this time has a lot more legs. You know, it is equal parts craft, science, and art history. And then at the same time, I would also add in, you know, we are now understanding a lot of technology and other sorts of outreach. There's a lot of value added that I think a conservator could have in the archival space. And again, you know, in the past, we've been positioned as these kind of people that say no, and that's not what we do. We really are there to facilitate and to think broadly about how we can achieve, you know, goals.
That's really inspiring. And I would urge everyone to get in touch with a conservator near you, so to speak, because there's a lot of value add and a lot to learn. Sarah, thank you so much. This was really wonderful. Yeah. One of the last takeaways in the checklist, which Sarah and I crafted together, was to look beyond your own fashion archive, if you're a fashion brand, and consider more ways to support fashion heritage and heritage in general. One brand is already doing that in spades. It's no surprise that it's a brand for which I have a distinct passion and one which I've already spotlighted on this podcast. Yes, you guessed it, Ferragamo. So don't leave the dinner party just yet, because in the second part of this episode on fashion and cultural partnerships over espresso and hopefully some dolce, I'll be speaking to Giuseppe Abbatista, an Italian attorney, tax specialist, and Ferragamo's own tax consultant, about the legal and, yes, financial benefits for a fashion brand that supports heritage outside of a museum, especially in the public square or piazza.